Chapter 39. Ideas suggested by the Feast of Calabashes, inaccuracy of certain published accounts of the islands, a reason neglected state of heathenism and the valley effigy of a dead warrior, a singular superstition, the priest Collery, and the god Moa Archua, amazing religious observance, a dilapidated shrine, Cori Cori and the idol, an inference, although I had been baffled in my attempts to learn the origin of the Feast of Calabashes, yet it seemed very plain to me that it was principally, if not wholly, of a religious character. As a religious solemnity, however, it had not at all corresponded with the horrible descriptions of Polynesian worship which we have received in some published narratives, and especially in those accounts of the evangelized islands with which the missionaries have favored us. Did not the sacred character of these persons render the purity of their intentions unquestionable, I should certainly be led to suppose that they had exaggerated the evils of paganism in order to enhance the merit of their own disinterested labors. In a certain work incidentally treating of the Washington, or Northern Marquesas Islands, apostrophe, I have seen the frequent immolation of human victims upon the altars of their gods, positively and repeatedly charged upon the inhabitants. The same work gives also a rather minute account of their religion, enumerates a great many of their superstitions, and makes known the particular designations of numerous orders of the priesthood. One would almost imagine from the long list that is given of cannibal primates, bishops, archdeacons, prebendaries, and other inferior ecclesiastics, that the sacerdotal order far outnumbered the rest of the population, and that the poor natives were more severely priest-ridden than even the inhabitants of the papal states. These accounts are likewise calculated to leave upon the reader's mind an impression that human victims are daily cooked and served up upon the altars, that heathenish cruelties of every description are continually practiced, and that these ignorant pagans are in a state of the extremest wretchedness in consequence of the grossness of their superstitions. Be it observed, however, that all this information is given by a man who, according to his own statement, was only at one of the islands, and remained there but 2 weeks, sleeping every night on board his ship, and taking little kid glove excursions ashore in the daytime, attended by an armed party. Now, all I can say is, that in all my excursions through the valley of Taipei, I never saw any of these alleged enormities. If any of them are practiced upon the Marquesas Islands, they must certainly have come to my knowledge while living for months with a tribe of savages, wholly unchanged from their original primitive condition, and reputed the most ferocious in the South Seas. The fact is, that there is a vast deal of unintentional humbuggery in some of the accounts we have from scientific men concerning the religious institutions of Polynesia. These learned tourists generally obtain the greater part of their information from retired old South Sea rovers, who have domesticated themselves among the barbarous tribes of the Pacific. Jack, who has long been accustomed to the long bow, and to spin tough yarns on the ship's forecastle, invariably officiates as showman of the island on which he has settled, and having mastered a few dozen words of the language, is supposed to know all about the people who speak it. A natural desire to make himself of consequence in the eyes of the strangers prompts him to lay claim to a much greater knowledge of such matters than he actually possesses. In reply to incessant queries, he communicates not only all he knows but a good deal more, and if there be any information deficient, still he is at no loss to supply it. The avidity with which his anecdotes are noted down tickles his vanity, and his powers of invention increase with the credulity auditors. He knows just the sort of information wanted, and furnishes it to any extent. This is not a supposed case. I have met with several individuals like the one described, and I have been present at 2 or 3 of their interviews with strangers. Now, when the scientific voyager arrives at home with his collection of wonders, he attempts, perhaps, to give a description of some of the strange people he has been visiting. Instead of representing them as a community of lusty savages, who are leading a merry, idle, innocent life, he enters into a very circumstantial and learned narrative of certain unaccountable superstitions and practices, about which he knows as little as the islanders themselves. Having had little time, and scarcely any opportunity, to become acquainted with the customs he pretends to describe, he writes them down one after another in an offhand, haphazard style, and were the book thus produced to be translated into the tongue of the people, of whom it purports to give the history, it would appear quite as wonderful to them as it does to the American public, and much more improbable. For my own part, I am free to confess my almost entire inability to gratify any curiosity that may be felt with regard to the theology of the valley. I doubt whether the inhabitants themselves could do so. They are either too lazy, or too sensible to worry themselves about abstract points of religious belief. While I was among them, they never held any synods or councils to settle the principles of their faith by agitating them. An unbounded liberty of conscience seemed to prevail. Those who pleased to do so were allowed to repose implicit faith in an ill-favored god with a large bottlenose, and fat shapeless arms crossed upon his breast, whilst others worshipped an image which, having no likeness either in heaven or on earth, could hardly be called an idol. As the islanders always maintained a discreet reserve with regard to my own peculiar views on religion, I thought it would be excessively ill-bred of me to pry into theirs. But, although my knowledge of the religious faith of the Typees was unavoidably limited, one of their superstitious observances with which I became acquainted interested me greatly. In one of the most secluded portions of the valley within a stone's cast of Fayaway's Lake Fort, so I christened the scene of our island yachting, and hard by a growth of palms, which stood ranged in order along both banks of the stream, waving their green arms, as if to do honor to its passage, was the mausoleum of a deceased warrior chief. Like all the other edifices of any note, it was raised upon a small pie of stones, which, being of unusual height, was a conspicuous object from a distance. A light thatching of bleached palmetto leaves hung over it like a self-supported canopy, for it was not until you came very near that you saw it was supported by four slender columns of bamboo rising at each corner to a little more than the height of a man. A clear area of a few yards surrounded the pie, and was enclosed by four trunks of coconut trees resting at the angles on massive blocks of stone. The place was sacred. The sign of the inscrutable taboo was seen in the shape of a mystic roll of white tappa, suspended by a twisted cord of the same material from the top of a slight pole planted within the enclosure. The sanctity of the spot appeared never to have been violated. The stillness of the grave was there, and the calm solitude around was beautiful and touching. The soft shadows of those lofty palm trees. I can see them now hanging over the little temple, as if to keep out the intrusive sun. White appears to be the sacred color among the Marquesans. On all sides as you approached this silent spot you caught sight of the dead chief's effigy, seated in the stern of a canoe, which was raised on a light frame a few inches above the level of the pie. The canoe was about 7 feet in length, of a rich, dark-colored wood, handsomely carved and adorned in many places with variegated bindings of stained sinnate, into which were ingeniously wrought a number of sparkling seashells, and a belt of the same shells, ran all round it. The body of the figure of whatever material it might have been made was effectually concealed in a heavy robe of brown tappa, revealing only the hands and head, the latter skillfully carved in wood, and surmounted by a superb arch of plumes. These plumes, in the subdued and gentle gales which found access to this sequestered spot, were never for one moment at rest, but kept nodding and waving over the chief's brow. The long leaves of the palmetto drooped over the eaves, and through them, you saw the warrior holding his paddle with both hands, in the act of rowing, leaning forward and inclining his head, as if eager to hurry on his voyage. Glaring at him forever, and face to face, was a polished human skull, which crowned the prow of the canoe. The spectral figurehead, reversed in its position, glancing backwards, seemed to mock the impatient attitude of the warrior. When I first visited this singular place with Cory, he told me, or at least I so understood him, that the chief was paddling his way to the realms of bliss, and breadfruit to Polynesian heaven, where every moment the breadfruit trees dropped their ripened spheres to the ground, and where there was no end to the coconuts and bananas. There they reposed through the livelong eternity upon mats much finer than those of Taipei, and every day bathed their glowing limbs in rivers of coconut oil. In that happy land there were plenty of plumes and feathers, and boar's tusks and sperm whale teeth, far preferable to all the shining trinkets and gay tappa of the white men, and, best of all, women far lovelier than the daughters of earth were there in abundance. A very pleasant place, apostrophe Cory said it was, but after all, not much pleasanter, he thought, than Taipei. Apostrophe did he not then, apostrophe I asked him, wish to accompany the warrior? Apostrophe oh no. He was very happy where he was, but supposed that some time or other he would go in his own canoe. Apostrophe, thus far, I think, I clearly comprehended Cory. But there was a singular expression he made use of at the time, enforced by a singular gesture, the meaning of which I would have given much to penetrate. I am inclined to believe it must have been a proverb he uttered, for I afterwards heard him repeat the same words several times, and in what appeared to me to be a somewhat similar sense. Indeed, Cory had a great variety of short, smart-sounding sentences, with which he frequently enlivened his discourse, and he introduced them with an air which plainly intimated that in his opinion, they settled the matter in question, whatever it might be. Could it have been then, that when I asked him whether he desired to go to this heaven of breadfruit, coconuts, and young ladies, which he had been describing, he answered by saying something equivalent to our old adage, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush? If he did, Cory was a discreet and sensible fellow, and I cannot sufficiently admire his shrewdness. Whenever, in the course of my rambles through the valley I happened to be near the chief's mausoleum, I always turned aside to visit it. The place had a peculiar charm for me, I hardly know why, but so it was. As I leaned over the railing, and gazed upon the strange effigy, and watched the play of the feathery headdress, stirred by the same breeze which in low tones breathed amidst the lofty palm trees, I loved to yield myself up to the fanciful superstition of the islanders, and could almost believe that the grim warrior was bound heavenward. In this mood when I turned to depart, I bade him Godspeed, and a pleasant voyage. Apostrophe I, paddle away, brave chieftain, to the land of spirits. To the material eye thou makest but little progress, but with the eye of faith, I see thy canoe cleaving the bright waves, which die away on those dimly looming shores of paradise. This strange superstition affords another evidence of the fact, that however ignorant man may be, he still feels within him his immortal spirit yearning after the unknown future. Although the religious theories of the islands were a complete mystery to me, their practical everyday operation could not be concealed. I frequently passed the little temples reposing in the shadows of the taboo groves, and beheld the offerings moldy fruit spread out upon a rude altar, or hanging in half-decayed baskets around some uncouth jolly-looking image. I was present during the continuance of the festival. I daily beheld the grinning idols marshaled rank and file in the hula-hula ground, and was often in the habit of meeting those whom I supposed to be the priests. But the temple seemed to be abandoned to solitude. The festival had been nothing more than a jovial mingling of the tribe. The idols were quite harmless as any other logs of wood, and the priests were the merriest dogs in the valley. In fact, religious affairs in Taipei were at a very low ebb. All such matters sat very lightly upon the thoughtless inhabitants, and, in the celebration of many of their strange rites, they appeared merely to seek a sort of childish amusement. A curious evidence of this was given in a remarkable ceremony in which I frequently saw Mehevi and several other chefs and warriors of note take part, but never a single female. Among those whom I looked upon as forming the priesthood of the valley, there was one in particular who often attracted my notice, and whom I could not help regarding as the head of the order. He was a noble-looking man, in the prime of his life, and of a most benignant aspect. The authority this man, whose name was Collery, seemed to exercise over the rest, the episcopal party took in the Feast of Calabashes, his sleek and complacent appearance, the mystic characters which were tattooed upon his chest, and above all the mitre he frequently wore, in the shape of a towering headdress, consisting of part of a coconut branch, the stalk planted uprightly on his brow, and the leaflets scattered together, and passed round the temples, and behind the ears, all these pointed him out as Lord Primate of Taipei. Collery was a sort of Knight Templar, a soldier priest, for he often wore the dress of a Marquesan warrior, and always carried a long spear, which, instead of terminating in a paddle at the lower end, after the general fashion of these weapons, was curved into a heathenish-looking little image. This instrument, however, might perhaps have been emblematic of his double functions. With one end in carnal combat he transfixed the enemies of his tribe, and with the other as a pastoral crook he kept in order his spiritual flock. But this is not all I have to say about Collery. His martial grace very often carried about with him what seemed to me the half of a broken war club. It was swathed round with ragged bits of white tappa, and the upper part, which was intended to represent a human head, was embellished with a strip of scarlet cloth of European manufacture. It required little observation to discover that this strange object was revered as a god. By the side of the big and lusty images standing sentinel over the altars of the hula hula ground, it seemed a mere pygmy in tatters. But appearances all the world over are deceptive. Little men are sometimes very potent, and rags sometimes cover very extensive pretensions. In fact, this funny little image was the crack god of the island, lording it over all the wooden lubbers who looked so grim and dreadful. Its name was Moa Archua, and it was in honor of Moa Archua, and for the entertainment of those who believe in him, that the curious ceremony I am about to describe was observed. The word Archua, although having some other significations, is in nearly all the Polynesian dialects used as the general designation of the gods. Mehevi and the chieftains of the Ti have just risen from their noontide slumbers. There are no affairs of state to dispose of, and having eaten two or three breakfasts in the course of the morning, the magnates of the valley feel no appetite as yet for dinner. How are their leisure moments to be occupied? They smoke, they chat, and at last one of their number makes a proposition to the rest, who joyfully acquiescing, he darts out of the house, leaps from the pie, and disappears in the grove. Soon you see him returning with Collery, who bears the god Moa Archua in his arms, and carries in one hand a small trough, hollowed out in the likeness of a canoe. The priest comes along dandling his charge, as if it were a lachrymous infant he was. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.